The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
June 2006. In the dead of night, a Chinook helicopter lifted off from a secluded desert airbase in Iraq. Inside, elite troops from Britain's Special Air Service, the SAS, were sitting side by side. They were checking their weapons, ammunition, night vision goggles, and radio equipment. These fighters were part of a secretive unit, codenamed Task Force Black. They were traveling towards a remote farmhouse on the outskirts of Baghdad. Inside was their target, Abu Musab al-Zakari, the mastermind behind countless bombings, kidnappings, and beheadings as the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. As the operation approached the farmhouse, two smaller helicopters flanked them.
They were accompanied by a couple of smaller helicopters, Lynxes, with snipers in them that would orbit over the target. And then last in the order, if you like, of this little flying armada were a couple of bigger helicopters with the force that would be used to put what they call the cordon around the Alpha, the cordon being the belt of security. So that if anybody jumped out the window and made a run for it, squirters, as they called them, either the people in the helicopters, the orbiting snipers, or the cordon would take care of those people.
The fighters landed stealthily onto the desert floor and began closing in on the property. Two scouts climbed over a small stone wall and crawled towards the farmhouse, looking for signs of life and possible entrance points. Pinning their backs against the uneven concrete, they peered through a crack in the wall to catch a glimpse inside.
Inside the building was, if you like, a protection detail of people for this particular emir that the SAS had targeted. There were at least two, possibly three, wearing suicide vests. There were half a dozen assault rifles. There were dozens of hand grenades. These people were heavily armed.
They must be protecting something, or someone important. But could it be Abu Musab al-Zakari? Finally, after years of brutal anarchy in the war-torn country, could this be his end? Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations.
The entire country was essentially embroiled in a civil war. I mean, there was beheadings every day, there were suicide bombings, there was this retaliatory acts of terrorism going on between the Sunni and Shia. And so every day you would wake up and read about murders and decapitations and all types of horrible acts.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special operations missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives. Abu Musab al-Zakari had been thought to be responsible for years-long bloody war in Iraq. But who was this evil man?
I think arguably over the last several years, no single person on this planet has had the blood of more innocent men, women, and children on his hands than Zarqawi.
And how and why did Zarqawi's terror begin?
What al-Zarqawi is doing in Iraq is trying to destroy completely the state in order to rebuild it. And then from the ashes of this state, we will rebuild the new state. And this new state will be a sort of carbon copy of the old caliphate.
This is the true story of Task Force Black and the killing of one of Iraq's most vicious terrorist leaders, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. This is Assault on Al-Qaeda, Part 1. The rest of the fighters from Task Force Black joined the scouts at the perimeter wall of the rustic farm building, but as they drew near, something surprised them. Mark Urban is the author of 2011's Task Force Black, the explosive true story of the Special Secret Forces War in Iraq.
As the SAS men from B Squadron of 22 SAS started to move towards the Alpha, the target, they realized it was not going to be a typical sort of mission. They thought they could hear sounds inside the building. They approached the building very gingerly, and a few of the men walked around a parked car that was under a car park, and to their surprise and satisfaction found that there was a door just wide open behind the car.
If al-Zarqawi, one of the world's most wanted terrorists, was inside, why would he leave the door wide open? Would it be so easy to get inside? The unit opted to enter the compound through the door, only to find it was a trap.
Almost as soon as they were through the door, they were hit by a hail of bullets. The people inside clearly knew somebody was coming, they were armed, and they were waiting. So they fired this initial volley of bullets, they hit a couple of the SAS guys. The SAS guys withdrew. Obviously, they had casualties to treat, so they withdrew to a safe distance. The airwaves were alive at that moment with reports that there was resistance inside the building and that they needed to take the appropriate action, immediate action, to deal with that resistance. Immediately, for the commander on the spot, there were a number of very difficult questions. In some of these incidents where heavy resistance was encountered, they simply pulled back and dropped a bomb on the building and killed everybody inside. For many different reasons, the SAS commander on the ground decided not to do that. They wanted this person alive for intelligence purposes.
The longer they withdrew from the action, the more opportunity the terrorists would have to destroy data that could lead the coalition forces to other al-Qaeda compounds. The team, again, advanced towards the open door.
They felt it was worth trying to fight their way in, and that's what they did. They went into the building, they started to engage people in the darkness, in the rooms, as they went into the building, trying to clear it room by room.
Task Force Black ran through the building, taking out each al-Qaeda operative in their path, while al-Qaeda fighters sprayed the night air with AK-47 fire. But the al-Qaeda cell were no match for the methodical and controlled fighting style of Task Force Black. They suffered many casualties. Now the downstairs was secured, but the upstairs still needed to be investigated. As one of the SAS fighters entered the stairwell of the farmhouse, the top of the stairs above him was dark, with no sign of life. He slowly walked up the stairs, readying himself for any signs of booby traps or ambush. As he reached the top step on the stairs, a figure appeared.
As one of the SAS men, who was a staff sergeant, a team leader, went up the stairs to the upper level, there was a suicide bomber waiting for him at the top of the stairs who detonated his suicide device. There was an explosion. The SAS man was blown down the stairs.
There was a man down, but special forces continued up the stairs, moving past the now dead suicide bomber. The rest of the house was cleared. The fighters scanned the rooms. To their horror, several women and children were caught up in the blast. Tragically, there were no survivors among them. The soldier, however, was still breathing, with only slight bruising and minor lacerations. He would recover. Meanwhile, operatives had captured 5 male al-Qaeda hostages. With the house now clear of threat, Task Force Black started looking for any evidence linking the house with al-Zarqawi. And to the team's surprise, the sound of footsteps came from above them. A grenade hit the ground outside the compound next to the entrance of the property, followed by a flurry of machine gun fire.
There were other people. They'd been throwing grenades and opening fire at the SAS. They were killed too. Another man wearing a suicide vest, a squirter as they call it, fled out the back of the building and hid under a car that was parked behind the building. He was taken out. It's not clear whether it was by one of the snipers in the helicopters or by the cordon forces that were around the building, the target building, the Alpha. So at the end of a sort of terrifying 20 minutes There were a whole lot of dead people in this building, including one person who'd blown himself up in an attempt to kill the SAS soldiers. Another who hadn't had a chance to detonate his vest was lying dead under the car. There were spent cases, grenades scattered everywhere. One of the dead Al-Qaeda members that the SAS men stepped across, I've seen a photo of this, had a grenade in his hand with the pin removed, and clearly they stepped quite gingerly across him as they tried to see what else was in the building.
The special ops mission proved to be a success.
Inside the house, we captured five senior-ranking members of Al-Qaeda. We didn't know it at the time that they were senior-ranking. We thought or suspected they were because of the way they dressed and because of their mannerisms, but we didn't really know what we had.
That's the voice of Matthew Alexander, a senior military interrogator who oversaw the team and tasked with finding out who those five men were, and more importantly, if they could lead him to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
This was a guy who had murdered thousands of people. In fact, he murdered many more people than Osama bin Laden ever did. You know, you could say Zarqawi could be responsible for upwards of almost 100,000 deaths by starting the civil war in Iraq. He wanted to be the leader of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And he saw this struggle as, you know, part of the larger Al-Qaeda struggle for dominance in the Middle East. But for Zarqawi, it was really all about him. And, you know, his strategy was to start a civil war in Iraq between Sunni and Shia, and he believed American forces would get mired down in that civil conflict, and then the American public would demand that we be withdrawn. What he didn't count on is that we would stay.
Now, I know you've heard me talk about the Great Courses Plus before, and I want to bring it up again because I really can't speak highly enough of these folks. I love their streaming service. It's called The Great Courses Plus, and it's a priceless source of knowledge in just about any field. It's a streaming service that offers thousands of different lectures on a billion different topics. Now, the word lecture conjures to mind a vision of me falling asleep on my backpack in a room full of 1,000 other students. This is not that. The topics are incredible, and they are taught by people who actually have done whatever it is they're teaching, and they really care about what they're talking to you about. You can learn about stuff from the human brain all the way to learning outdoor survival skills or how to play guitar, even. The one that I'm working on right now is Fundamentals of Photography. Truth be told, I am a terrible photographer. My wife yells at me whenever I take a selfie or try to take a picture of her and cutting off heads constantly. But this course is led by an award-winning National Geographic photographer, so you know he knows what he's talking about. Not only is he making sense of the camera settings, you know, all those little things that look like hieroglyphs that I could never figure out before, but he also gives you a lot of great tips and tricks to take better photos for work and family outings or even as a new hobby, no matter what type of camera you have. Not just technical, but also aesthetic stuff like where do you put the horizon or how do you frame a photograph? It's really pretty amazing. So I want to give you a special offer, and I want you to go there and do this right away, okay? Start learning with the Great Courses Plus today, and I've worked out a fantastic offer for my listeners, a full free month of unlimited access. That's all of the courses. You don't have to just take one special introductory course. It's all of their material free for a month, but you got to sign up using my exclusive URL, okay? So sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/covert. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/covert. Super important, /covert. Don't forget, thegreatcoursesplus.com/covert. To understand how al-Zarqawi rose to become one of the most feared terrorists on the planet, we must look to the town of Zarqa, Jordan, 500 miles to the west of Baghdad, where al-Zarqawi was born in 1966. Author of Insurgent Iraq, al-Zarqawi and the New Generation, Loretta Napoleoni.
Al-Zarqawi is a working class individual. He does not belong to an elitist family. In that, it's very, very different from the majority of the leaders of the jihadist movement and al-Qaeda.
His background is he was a criminal. You know, he spent time in a Jordanian prison for sexual assault. He was a drug dealer. He was a petty criminal in Jordan.
Well, there's a narrative which you find in the lives of quite a lot of people who got involved with Al-Qaeda. And I suppose you could say that there's a period in their lives which you might call the sinful years or the crazy years. I mean, you saw it with some of the 9/11 hijackers, that there was a period of their life when they'd been drinking heavily and doing lots of things which clearly Islam would consider very, very haram or unclean. Zarqawi was one of those people. I mean, the accounts differ as to whether he was actually a sort of hard boozing villain in his hometown. But it's certainly true that he was involved in some forms of crime and that he probably had some kind of epiphany, some kind of moment when he realised that his life was going the wrong way and that Islam was the answer for him. And of course, many of those people who had that kind of experience, often in jail, became the most militant jihadists because they felt they had redeemed their lives and discovered purpose.
In 1989, al-Zarqawi traveled to Afghanistan to become a freedom fighter against the Soviet occupation. It was there he met his mentor and inspiration, Osama bin Laden.
At the beginning of 2000, finally al-Zarqawi met Osama bin Laden. It was a very interesting meeting. Osama bin Laden was the leader of al-Qaeda, a very, very powerful man in Afghanistan. Al-Zarqawi was a nobody. He was the leader of this small group of individuals who did not even have a name, they did not have a base. And the reason why al-Zarqawi met Osama bin Laden is because he was looking for a sponsor. He basically was looking for money. He wanted to set up a little camp where he could look after his followers. Osama bin Laden offered al-Zarqawi to become part of al-Qaeda.
Former White House counterterrorism advisor Fran Townsend.
Zarqawi really came to at least my attention, and I think many in the counterterrorism community, during the millennium, the 99 to 2000 period. There had been a series of raids in Jordan. There was a threat inside Jordan. There was tremendous cooperation between the FBI, the CIA, and our Jordanian counterparts. In fact, we deployed a number of FBI agents over to Jordan to work with the CIA and the Jordanians. And during the course of that investigation, it became clear that the leader of this cell was an individual by the name of Zarqawi. We knew he was an important terrorist figure. We knew he was an important operational leader. I don't think anyone at that point in time imagined, you know, more than a decade later, we would be chasing him inside Iraq, where he would become an even more influential figure in al-Qaeda.
In the wake of September 11th, much of the al-Qaeda leadership went into hiding in the tribal belt between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The United States had begun its invasion of Afghanistan. Zarqawi and other al-Qaeda fighters, meanwhile, had crossed over to Iran and then into the northern Iraq region known as Kurdistan.
Now, that move is very much the beginning of the making of his myth, because the Americans were informed of the existence of al-Zarqawi at the end of 2001 by the Kurdish Secret Service. The Kurdish Secret Service alerted the Americans that al-Zarqawi was the link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
It was clear as we were in Iraq the increasing importance of Zarqawi inside al-Qaeda circles. He had come up during the course of the war in Afghanistan. People understood his importance as an operational leader, and he was clearly trusted by bin Laden and the al-Qaeda senior leadership. And so when he was deployed, if you will, from the federally administrated tribal areas into Iraq, we understood as the American counterterrorism community that this was a significant event. He was well-liked by the soldiers in al-Qaeda. He was well-respected by the leadership. He was incredibly capable. He was experienced. And so he had that unique combination of skills that would allow him to be a real force for al-Qaeda against us inside Iraq.
In 2003, the U.S. and other coalition forces entered Iraq, and the Saddam Hussein regime quickly collapsed. But it created a major power vacuum. Al-Zarqawi, who was hiding in the shadows, kick-started a campaign of violence. He stirred up the hatred between Iraq's two main religious groups, the majority Shia Muslims and the minority Sunnis. He then created a militant group with the aim of killing as many Shias as possible and sparking a brutal cycle of violence across the nation. And it was drawing the attention of the United States, especially Secretary of State Colin Powell.
On the 5th of February 2003, Colin Powell went to the Security Council and in front of the world presented al-Zarqawi as the link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Nobody had heard of al-Zarqawi before that day. I mean, everybody in the community of terrorist experts had never heard his name. Interestingly enough, from that moment onwards, al-Zarqawi became the man who masterminded the majority of the terrorist attack which had taken place after 9/11.
Al-Zarqawi's group was named by intelligence officials Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or for short, AQI.
When you look at Al-Qaeda's mission in Iraq and the Zarqawi mission, we mistakenly look at these organizations as terrorist groups. This is too narrow. These are revolutionary organizations that want to spread an idea. They can return to what they call a caliphate, a 14 centuries old concept that there's a pure way to live according to the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad.
Targets included bombing the offices of the United Nations and the Red Cross, regular attacks on the bases of U.S. military and coalition forces. But in an effort to maximize casualties, the terrorist group shifted its attention to targeting public markets, police stations, mosques, and with it, media coverage. And in the eyes of al-Zarqawi, this was attention on his movement and an important recruitment tool. Former interrogator and author of How to Break a Terrorist, Matthew Alexander.
There's a large influx of foreign fighters into Iraq after the Abu Ghraib scandal, which was essentially al-Qaeda's number one recruiting tool for convincing, young Muslims from all across, from everywhere from North Africa, all across the Middle East, to come to Iraq and fight in what they termed a jihad. And these foreign fighters were extremely potent because they were the ones who made it most of the suicide bombers. So they were the ones that essentially were also the most brutal. I think largely the acts that you would see, like beheadings, happened because of these foreign fighters and not so much because of Iraqis.
Al-Zarqawi orchestrated numerous suicide bombings. A devastating series of attacks in March 2004 killed close to 200 people at Shia holy sites.
Zarqawi was at the top of the target list inside Iraq, one, because of the bloodshed he was causing, and not just of Iraqis. I mean, this terrorist leader became a primary source of injuries and killings of our own soldiers and coalition forces, and so absolutely he became prominent on the scope of the president in terms of briefings and targets.
Then, on May 11th, 2004, al-Zarqawi became linked to a new outrage. U.S. intelligence analyst discovered a video on a jihadist website. It featured a civilian man being paraded in front of heavily armed al-Qaeda fighters. He wore a Guantanamo Bay-style orange jumpsuit. The analysts immediately recognized the civilian as Nick Berg, a 26-year-old communications expert from Pennsylvania. He had been kidnapped in Iraq a month previously. The video showed his unimaginably horrific death.
So Nick Berg, having gone there on a rather naive and optimistic hope he might find work, got kidnapped in the north of Iraq, and essentially he got sold by the kidnap gang to militant Islamists, who of course owed their loyalty to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. When the time came that he had outlived his usefulness to them, they murdered him. And the video is one of those horror show type of jihadist videos in which a long knife is used to cut his throat. And you can even hear the sound of knife on bone. And the screams. It's a truly horrific video. But the point is, at the beginning of the video, there's a caption. In the original form, it was released. And it says, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi slaughters an American. Now, a lot of people at the time couldn't quite understand why he was choosing to, if you like, incriminate himself in such a grand and grisly fashion. He appeared in the video. He's thought to have wielded the knife. The intelligence analysts who looked at it felt that the words of the figure speaking in the video were him. It was his voice based on previous analysis of the voice. But he was hooded. So why do this? Why incriminate yourself by putting your name at the beginning of the video? The general view was that in the kind of propaganda of the deed that very much informed the jihad at the time, that Zarqawi could see that if he publicized himself and what he was doing as a really militant, irreconcilable enemy of the Americans, that this would bring him money from the collections in mosques for the jihad, it would bring him volunteers from across the Arab world, and in that calculation, he was right.
Do you ever wonder why the big wireless providers in 2019 cost so much? I mean, that's true with like TVs and electrical equipment and cars, all that stuff. So why are they still so expensive? It's because of the retail stores, the inflated prices, and the hidden fees you're being taken advantage of, because they know that you'll pay. Want an alternative? Mint Mobile. The exact same network coverage you're used to, because they use the exact same networks. It's no different. There's not a Mint Mobile dude out there on a tree waving around a cell reception thingy. It's the same network that one of the big four uses to power their network. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, and that's how they pass those savings on directly to you, because you're going to pay a fraction of the cost. Mint Mobile makes it easy for you to cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you can stop paying for unlimited data that you'll never use. You can choose between plans of 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data. You can use your own phone with Mint Mobile, because what they don't tell you with the big phones is that you can have them unlock your phone for you. So you're not stuck with them because you bought a phone from them. I didn't know that, by the way. The folks at Mint Mobile helped me with that. So to get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/covert. That's mintmobile.com/covert. And that's important, /covert. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/covert. Once again, former FBI and CIA senior official Philip Mudd.
The guy was so brutal, so tough. It's sort of like a mafia family operating in New York City. If you kill everybody else, eventually people stand back and say, whoa, we got a big guy, a big dog on the corner in town, and we better be careful. So just the brutality and the effectiveness of his efforts against first the Americans and then the locals, I think people stood back and say, this guy's a blowtorch. We better let him roll. It wasn't that we were losing. It was just, we should, you know, it was just like, when will this end and how will it end? I didn't have any sense that we had reached a crescendo.
Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Tom O'Connell.
Well, I don't think there's any question that he was intimately involved with a number of suicide bombings, beheadings. He certainly had a major propaganda campaign going. We knew him to be in contact with Osama bin Laden. He really put the crosshairs on his own head by all these spectacular acts and all the press that he was receiving. So he was important as a figurehead.
Berg's death was a signal to the world that al-Zarqawi's reign of terror was escalating to mythic proportions.
Well, I think the legend was bigger than the man, because what the Iraqi Sunnis started to believe, and those people who had joined al-Qaeda, was that if the Americans can't kill Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, can't stop him, then maybe he was predestined to win the war. And so you had little kids in the street, you know, pretending to be Abu Musab al-Zarqawi because he was essentially invincible. And the fact that we couldn't find him kind of added to his legend. And it also helped them to recruit new fighters, which was, you know, extremely important to them, was to be able to bring in other Sunni insurgent groups and foreign fighters into Iraq. And so finding Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was more than just decapitating, you know, the leadership of al-Qaeda. It was also about disproving the idea that al-Qaeda could win the war.
In Washington, ending al-Zarqawi's reign of terror had become a top priority for President Bush and his inner circle of advisors. Fran Townsend said that they had to untangle a web of small elements that made up Zarqawi's network.
With al-Qaeda in Iraq, frankly, what we said we needed to do when we saw them having the momentum was to step back and say, okay, what has given them this momentum? Clearly, they had these individual cells. Clearly, they were able to share bombing expertise. Clearly, they were moving some money and component pieces to explosives. And so you begin to break it down. You say, okay, I have to look at each of the discrete elements. How is he moving money? How are they communicating? Where are they getting the component pieces for? What are each of the components, and what would you need to do to put it together? And I'm going to target each discrete, tiny little element. And if I can begin to pull little elements away, suddenly the whole thing falls of its own weight. And that's exactly what happened. The president encouraged the entire community, military, intelligence, all of it, to look at how they could support each other in pulling discrete little elements away, to be creative, to find the technology that it was going to require and the intelligence it was going to require. And that's exactly what the military and the intelligence community did. You come in, and the days where you feel like the momentum hasn't been with you, you start with your thought is really so simple. It's let nothing blow up today. Let me get through today with nothing blowing up. And if I can string 2 and 3 and 4 days together, I can then switch the momentum. I mean, you start when the momentum's not with you and you're frustrated with very modest goals. Let us get through this day and figure out how to make that 2 days.
Al-Zarqawi seemed to have the power to strike at will, and yet somehow he remained completely hidden.
We really didn't know what he was doing in Iraq, and we didn't know, did he have wives there? Did he have kids there? Where was he moving? What was his support network?
I think what most counterterrorism officials will tell you is you go through periods where you feel beleaguered, right? You go through periods where you're making very limited progress and you're trying to understand why that is. Why does he seem to have momentum behind him? And you're trying to figure out, what can I do to change that dynamic? But anybody who's been in this fight will tell you that's what happens. You go through these periods and you've got to push through it. You've got to understand what is it that's giving him the momentum. And how do you take that away from him?
He was so well hidden that no one had a recent photo of him, let alone any idea where he might be. He didn't use a mobile phone for fear it would be tracked. He only met with a select group of trusted advisors whose whereabouts were also unknown. Finding al-Zarqawi would prove difficult, but not impossible. Over a period of analysis, they had picked up on a few predictable elements of Zarqawi's movements.
We knew that Zarqawi had a spiritual advisor. We knew that he was going to visit him. We had identified a car that he was going to take to get there. And so as you got each of those little elements, you understood that it was absolutely inevitable that we'd be successful. It was just a matter of being patient, because eventually we had enough intelligence and enough of a network that eventually he was going to make a mistake and give us an opportunity, and that's exactly what happened.
Through the combined efforts of interrogators,
we were under a tremendous amount of pressure to deliver results quickly. Every day, we were reminded of how important it was to find and kill or capture Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, because he was the key to winning the war. And that pressure was reinforced from a variety of leaders, continuously on us.
And Task Force Black.
The momentum had shifted. The raids of his network were getting faster and closer to him, and so you had the sense, we're going to get there. You had an increase in confidence that we were getting closer, that we were putting the squeeze on him, and that the military was ultimately going to be successful.
Al-Zarqawi's final days are upon him. That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It's produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. You can also find us on Instagram @Covert Podcast. And if you've got some time, give us a review.